Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/news ad free. That's amazon.com/news ad free to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
This episode of Politics Without the Boring Bits is sponsored by BT, because BT means business. BT knows that businesses come in many shapes, sizes, and guises, from the person just starting out at their kitchen table to the biggest employer, which is why no matter what line of work you're in, they've got your back to help you succeed and do what you do best. No doubt connectivity is a must in Westminster, and it certainly helped us to get this episode created and distributed to you listening right now. BT already connects more than 1 million businesses and public sector organisations, offering secure and reliable connectivity. Nearly three quarters of people running a business or side hustle feel they couldn't do so without reliable broadband and mobile connectivity. That's why having connectivity you can count on is a must for business, whether it be facilitating multiple devices being connected at once or making team calls or guest Wi-Fi access for customers. BT's connectivity helps keep you and your customers happy. Whatever your business, BT's got your back. Search BT's got your back.
Hello, this is the Red Box Podcast. I'm Matt Sholley. Now, on the podcast, quite a lot, you'll hear me saying the politicians should have done this, they should have done that. Well, coming up on today's episode, you'll be able to hear what happened when I tried my hand at actual politics. Henry Zeffman, you'll know, chief political correspondent at the Times, regular on the podcast. Him and I went to a play. It's called Crisis. What Crisis? It's an immersive experience where the audience have to try and save the Callaghan government in 1979. We try our hand at negotiating with unions, the media, whipping MPs, making the numbers add up in the Treasury, and then there's a big vote, and we have to see if we manage to save the government or not. I'll be honest, we weren't very good at the media side of things, but you can hear exactly what happened. You'll hear from Henry and the director and the writer behind the play. That's coming up in our main thing on the podcast. But first, it's our columnist panel, and on a Friday, it is Times columnist Melanie Reid and James Forsyth. Britain needs the royal family more than ever. That's what you call swimming against the tide in the week when Prince Andrew's been making all of the news. Explain why the royals are so important.
Well, I think whatever you think of our constitutional arrangements, I mean, the last few years have shown the benefit of having a branch of a state that can rise above politics. Brexit has obviously put a particular strain on our relations with our closest neighbours, and in particular the French and the Irish. And I think one of the benefits of the royal family is that they can, through their visits and their work, act as a kind of subtle reminder about the depth of the ties that bind the UK to its neighbours, and also that everyone is still going to have to live on the same continent and be neighbours at the end of all this. So however tempting it may be, the two sides should not fall out completely over Brexit.
And on you make the interesting point as well, is that Prince Charles, his sort of time has come. You know, all that talking to his pot plants and wanging on about the environment when nobody was particularly interested. Now he's absolutely, this is his moment.
Yeah, and I think if you think about his interest, as you say, his interest in sustainability, global warming, these all used to be mocked. You know, when he talked about 100 months to save the planet, everyone thought he was, you know, there was a certain amount of derision in the press. I think if you look at events since then, the point he is trying to make is almost being made for him. And I also think there is an element here that lots of people always say, what's the point of a Commonwealth? It is purely an anachronism. I actually think that it has a particularly valuable role when it comes to discussing climate change, because it actually contains all the different people that you need to get to move in some ways, or examples of those countries. You've obviously got Britain, the first industrialised country. You've got India, a country that is emitting more as it develops and obviously understandably wants to develop. And you've also got those small island nations that are most vulnerable to climate change. And so it is actually a forum in which I think there is a chance to make some progress on these kind of issues.
What about you, Melanie? Where do you stand on the royals?
Yeah, well, I think Charles is a genuine environmentalist. I don't think he's only asked about that. And I think Prince William is also proving himself to be very interested and is building on that. I think there's a kind of an interesting psychology here because, you know, politicians are neutral, but I suppose the royal family are the closest thing we have to unifiers. You know, it's that sort of quasi-religious thing. You know, they're above politics. They represent something that's bigger and less venal and much wider and more universal than politicians who just want... Politicians always want something, you know. They aren't benign, whereas, of course, the royals always want something too, but it's a far less... It's a far less obvious thing. We can be far less cynical about it. And I think the royals can really build on this. And I think it's also a great distraction. They will see it as a great distraction to have a role like this, important role with gravitas, that takes them away from all the gossip and psychodrama of Andrew and obviously Harry's book coming next year, which is, you know, so they need this as much as politicians need them right now, I think.
Yeah, it's mutually beneficial for them all to have that role. I tell you what, as you've mentioned Howie's memoir that's coming out, Melanie, I'm not sure that it have much in common with Len McCluskey's, the outgoing Unite General Secretary. But there is something about, we do love a good memoir. Do we love a good political memoir, James? Or Melanie? Yes. Do you bother reading them?
I read and review a lot. I mean, Assassination by Memoir is just great. Just great. I mean, I'm sure James will know lots of the political ones, but I'm just actually reviewing at the moment Billie Jean King's autobiography, which is she lets loose on Margaret Court, the great her great rival for the way she was always being beastly about. She's now totally beastly about gay people, and you had John Humphreys. Look at John Humphreys, you know, destroying the posh, left leaning. Metropolitan Boys Club that was running the BBC. It's great stuff.
What about you, James? How? I mean, the trouble is that politics does produce a lot of very boring memoirs.
Yes, and I think the other thing that causes problems for memoirs is newspaper serialisations. The danger is that all the juicy stuff, it comes out in the newspaper serialisation, and then you diligently read the book and find that you could have saved quite a bit of time if you just read the newspaper serialisation of it. I think what's amusing about the Len McCluskey book is it seems to be a very clever marketing ploy in that they seem to have blacked out various passages. And there's nothing like blacking out a passage to make everyone think that what's underneath must be truly explosive, and I think it's another reminder that Len McCluskey might be a kind of firebrand trade unionist, but he's also quite a canny capitalist who knows how to work the market system to his advantage.
Yeah, the worst thing about a newspaper serialisation is when you read it and you think, this is boring. And you think, if that's the best bits they've taken out of the book, I'm definitely not going to bother tackling this. But whose memoirs do you think have been particularly good? I was thinking that, because Len McCluskey is going to drop his memoir on, I think, the eve of the Labour Party conference to make it as explosive as possible. The one I really sticks in my mind was Damien McBride's book about being a spin doctor for Gordon Brown, which, again, he dropped in the middle of the Labour Party conference. He was the biggest name in town that that conference, and it sort of completely overshadowed everything that was going on there. Which political biographies do you think were particularly good?
I think the McBride one is so good because it is very honest. He's not trying to create his reputation for the history books. There's that amazing bit when he reveals that he used to leak stories to the papers and insist that Gordon Brown's rivals were written up in a positive light, which seems counterintuitive. And so he goes on to explain that there was no better way to make Number 10 suspicious of these people than to have them written up in the newspaper as heroically standing up to Number 10 on some issue. And it's just his revealing of his devilment and the fact that he doesn't care about revealing the dubious ethics of his behaviour. That is what makes it so compelling, because sometimes you read memoirs and you can see that, you know, the people are trying to obey the Churchill dictum that, you know, history will be kind to me because I will write it myself, and they're very self-consciously writing for the history books. I think it is actually those people who really don't care what history thinks about them. You know, Damien McBride, Alan Clark, these are the people who write the most revealing memoirs, I think.
Does it also help if it's someone who's a bit more junior? Because actually, prime ministerial memoirs are a bit dull.
Yeah, but because obviously, any prime minister memoir is going to be an exercise in self-justification.
Yes.
And I think it is your Chris Mullins, as you say. It is those kind of people who can be much franker about, you know, or what went wrong, or they can kind of laugh at where they were in the food chain. I think if you're a prime minister, your memoir is inevitably going to concentrate on trying to kind of redefine how your premiership is seen. You know, I suspect that when Theresa May gets around to writing hers, you know, we'll find that, you know, that her premiership was far more concerned with, you know, issues that she obviously did care about, like modern slavery, but there'll be far more on that, I suspect, than on the numerous Brexit votes which went against her and the like. I mean, I think this is always the challenge, which is that a good memoir needs to be written by someone who doesn't really care that much what posterity is going to say about them.
Well, isn't that why Alan Clark was so brilliant? Because he was a total anarchist in that sense. He didn't give a damn. He really did not care. And he didn't care who he insulted or how politically incorrect he was. And it was glorious.
Yeah, and more recently, Alan Duncan's very similar, you know, actually being quite honest and blunt, or even the Sacha Swire diaries, happily torching all bridges to go back. Yeah, I'm not sure. I'm not sure if there's any news on whether or not Theresa May is going to write a memoir, or indeed if.
Well, that Gavin Barwell's memoirs, her chief of staff's memoirs, are coming out shortly, but I think there's no news yet on Theresa. I think Theresa May is and unless it's all this, is actually making rather a lot of money on the speech making circuit at the moment. So I suspect that is taking precedence.
I think you could.
I mean, we can look forward, can't we, to at some point Dominic Cummings's and also to Boris Johnson's.
Well, Dominic Cummings is sort of writing it in real time. He'll just have to edit down all of his blogs.
I would like to be a sub editor on that book.
I think you could be right. One other thing I wanted to touch on with you both is we've had exam results out this week, and every year there's like, oh, we'll have a big push this year to try and get people to speak modern languages. And it doesn't seem to be working. German suffered a dramatic fall overall to the number of choosing foreign languages flatlined, although Spanish does seem to be up. Is this a problem, Melanie? Do we need to be? I mean, it slightly goes back to James's point about sort of reconnecting with our European colleagues. It's not ideal if we're all just going to just decide, well, now after Brexit, we don't need to learn any languages. We're just going to stay here.
Well, on the practical front, it's going to cost the economy billions. I mean, they've estimated that if we shrink our hinterland of our children like this, we're not going to have the skills they need to for outreach. But I also think we impoverish ourselves culturally. This is sort of flattening. We just live on the internet because it's all in English. Charlemagne, the French, the great French king, the early Middle Ages, he said, if you speak another language, you inhabit another world. And that's such a wonderful thing, that, because it means that it opens up the world to you, and you have more identity, you have much more understanding. And I think there is a real danger that we become more and more insular. It's worth fighting for, I think. Languages are really worth fighting for.
What do you think, James? Do you speak any languages?
I can speak kind of bad restaurant French and Spanish. I think Melanie is completely right, and I think it has a kind of real consequences too. I mean, at the moment, for example, there is an absolutely fascinating election in Germany. You've got the CDU with a weak candidate falling. You've got the Greens in second place, narrowly ahead of the SPD, who have the candidate who is regarded by the electorate as the best potential chancellor. And if this election was taking place in an English-speaking country, I think Westminster would be fascinated by it. And there'd be huge discussions about the ramifications for the UK of who wins or what the coalition formations are. But because so few people, and I include myself in Westminster, can read the German press, we really don't know very much about it at all. And I think I think one of the reasons why, we are so much more interested in US politics than the politics of our neighbours is so easy just to read about what's going on in the US, to understand it, to follow it. While as, you know, our lack of language skills does act as a kind of obstacle to understanding in detail the politics of other European countries. I think that is a real consequence. I also think one of the things that is difficult is, and you can see this, you know, trying to persuade teenagers, as Melanie says, when, you know, the European Union, even after Brexit, still conducts its business in largely in English, it's really hard to persuade. But I think one of the things that you find as you grow older is, you know, one of my big regrets is I kind of gave up all languages at 17. I really wish I hadn't done that now. And also, I think that one of the strong cases for learning languages at school is however much you whatever good intentions you might try, trying to learn a language on your own outside is just one of those things that I think, you know, very few people have the time or the self-discipline to manage.
Thanks for Scythe and Melanie Reid there. You can read them both in the Times of your week. Just get yourself a subscription. Go to thetimes.co.uk/timesredbox, where you can get your first month for free. Right, coming up, what happened when we tried to actually save the government?
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
You're listening to the Red Box Podcast. Now, crisis, what crisis? For the first time, I'm joined in the studio by actual Henry Zeffman. How are you?
I'm very well, actual Matt, surely. This is all very impressive. Lots of shiny lights and everything. Much more glamorous than the back streets of Washington I used to call you from at 7
exactly
in the
right.
Morning.
So regular listeners will know, Henry, when Times Radio launched last summer, was the Washington correspondent at the Times. And how many appearances on Times Radio have you made?
I've actually stopped counting, but for the after my appraisal in which I dropped in the number of appearances I'd made, but it was over 150 at that point.
Yeah, you made more individual appearances than anyone else. I think it's probably fair to say. Now, chief political correspondent of the Times, in a moment we'll explain why you're here. But you've got a TV show that could be remade, or a film.
It's a film.
It's a film. What is it?
Gangs of Newport.
Very good. Well done.
It took me
well
a long done. Time.
No, everyone in the gallery is shaking their heads. a special mention to Pete in Southsea, who's been in touch and suggested The Life of Hewish Episcopi, which is fine, but it's pronounced Hewish Episcopi. So I appreciate the effort to try and include the name of my school in a film, but that's not working. You can keep this coming at 8722, start mention the word Times. You can tweet me at Times Radio. My current favourite, I think, is probably True Romance, which a couple of people have sent in. If you could do better than that, 8722, start message with the word Times. Right, now then, we are going back to 1979. The government is facing a vote of no confidence. James Callaghan has a majority of zero. The unions are walking out. Inflation is soaring. Police are losing control of the streets. So could Henry Zeffman and I save the government? Well, that's what we did one night this week. Crisis, what crisis? It's a brilliant, immersive theatre experience for political nerds, which is why we thought you'd all enjoy it, where the audience negotiates with unions, runs the Treasury, whips MPs, and there's a different outcome every night. In a moment, we will hear from the play's director and writer. But first, let's take a listen to what happened when Henry and I tried our hands at sort of crossing from just telling politicians you're doing it all wrong to trying to actually do it ourselves. Let's take a listen. So, Henry, here we are. We are in the, I think it's like the headquarters of the Labour Party, with various areas set aside. There's an economic area, there's a press area, there's a sort of civil disobedience area. We're sitting on some sort of bright orange 1970s felt sofa. In front of you on the coffee table, on the very 1970s sort of fake wood coffee table, there's some London Underground maps that you've just really struggled to pack away because you've never seen a map before, and a copy of The Sun with on the front page, Crisis, What Crisis? It's actually a recreation of the actual Sun front page. What's the date on the paper?
22nd of January, 1979. And it begins, sun-tanned Premier Jim Callaghan breezed back into Britain yesterday and asked, crisis? What crisis?
Which is an actual, genuine front page of The Sun. Lorries, shops, jobs, chaos, and Jim blames the press. And what we're basically going to do now, over whatever, like a couple of hours, is we're going to be thrown into the politics of January 1979 in the heart of the Labour government and the Labour Party and trying to avoid a real crisis, which for you and I, Henry, as political journalists, is a terrifying prospect because our job is to just sit and go, well, I wouldn't have done that when somebody makes a terrible hash of something. And it could all go horribly wrong.
Welcome and thank you for assisting us here. Plucked as we have taken you from your various Whitehall environments where you assist as political secretaries in the various Labour ministries that you all work in. But we do need you out of the way because tonight we are doing a deal. A deal that is going to get the last trade union standing, or should I say striking, back to work. The lorry drivers are not moving still. People are starting to worry about when the shops are going to get refilled. And we have a plan. We have a deal on the table. George Deakin, the General Secretary of ERTU, is on his way to get that news out there on our terms, not only to the wider world, but also to the PLP, the Parliamentary Labour Party, which is rather good news indeed, because we have another problem that I'm sure some of you are aware of. The Leader of the Opposition has decided that it is time for her to, no pun intended, strike. A motion of no confidence has been put before the House.
Let's get to work!
Henry, I feel like we want to go and deal with the press.
I think having being exasperated by so many press officers in our time, it's time to go and do it properly.
Yeah, and I can't be doing with economics or or planning. So let's go and do the media.
We are not writing the headlines, right? The press hate it when you write their headlines for them. However, we do need to know what we're saying. We need to make sure that we've got nice snappy things that are easy for us to remember and easy for the public to remember as well.
Henry, this is terrible. We're having to come up with successful political slogans. It's much easier being rude about other people's. Do we trust the lorries?
We are the lorries, aren't we?
Are we the lorries? No.
We are not lorries, just to be very clear.
I'm sorry, I didn't follow that bit.
We're the Labour government. Do you remember, Henry? Henry, pay attention.
Neither the avian kinds nor the road.
Red lorry, yellow lorry.
We're team lorry.
Red lorry. Red lorry.
Red
lorry, get the lolly.
The lolly. Right.
Lolly.
The
lolly.
And we are emphatically not lorries. Yeah, we've got an early edition of the front cover of the Standard.
Yeah,
hide your head.
What?
Apparently, all we have to say, headline's not bad. Yeah. Labour says, jobs. You've said some rather interesting things. We are confident that we will make a deal soon, so somebody get on that. In the words of Labour aide John, we say red lorry, yellow lorry.
Yeah!
Cameron!
Comrades and friends, gather up, please!
Then no one's done as good a deal as us.
Gather around here, please!
Henry, we have just pushed up inflation by 2%.
Yeah, but it was 2%, 5% or 10%.
Which is more than the...
This is what the public have to understand, it's very hard.
Why can't the public and the press just be more understanding of the difficult decisions that hard-working politicians have to make?
Anybody who fancies themselves on the radio, let me know.
Do you want to do the radio?
Yeah, you might as well.
I'll do the radio.
Right, excellent, we've got a couple of people for the radio. Perfect. Matt and Manera, you're going on the radio, all right? I'm going to try and get you on with Bob Holness. Now, it's a good slot. It's going to be probably in about 20 minutes' time. And he's going to come at you with some very difficult questions because he's all about getting people having that big conversation, right?
I don't think I've ever used a pen.
That was your first in here. Yeah. So we said to Joan, they're calling her Joan Maynard, but I think it's Joan Maynard. The job is yours. Stop. Congratulations on the promotion, comrade. Stop. Look forward to your vote with government. Stop.
I think that's someone confusing a fax machine with a telegram. You didn't have to write the word stop on a fax machine when sending a fax. I don't know where the media man's gone. We were promised Bob Holness. I'm just being told that Bob Holness is going to poke and prod me quite hard.
It's just after 9 o'clock on a Monday. I'm Bob Holness. We're joined by representatives of the Labour government that is
trying to get a handle on this crisis.
I mean, I think the key thing is that we need to be focusing on here is jobs, 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 jobs.
Yes, I do have a copy of the Evening Standard in front of me. You are promising jobs, jobs, jobs,
well,
jobs, jobs.
We're not promising them. We're just saying jobs, jobs, jobs.
It seems that there may be a slight error in communication on exactly what jobs it is you're talking about, because they're very keen not to do their jobs, whereas you seem to just be saying the word jobs.
I mean, that is my job.
The vote is in half an hour. Let's get to work.
Let's do some whipping. I think we should do some whipping. Okay. We're happy to talk to David Steele.
And
or whatever.
We'll go and get Pied on board.
I'm going to take that.
Yes. Very good.
Right.
All right, come on, Henry.
All right.
So we need to now go to the Treasury and ask for the cash.
To give them Welsh language TV.
Pied will be on board. We'll basically win the day.
You want money for a Welsh language television channel?
We think it's very important for the Welsh.
You just said it was to get Pied on board.
Who are Welsh?
Well, yes, they are. The clue is in the name.
We've got the money for Clyde. Who do we call?
You ring Winkle Evans.
All right.
201-202-0302.
Where's the phone? All the phone lines are taken. We're going to lose because of the phones. We need the phone. It's very important.
They're all busy.
Could you put me through to Gwynfor Evans from Clyde Cymru, please? That's right. Thank you so much.
Oh, good evening, Gwynfor Evans. I'm calling from the government. Are you well? You've been better. Oh, well, let me see what I can do to try and make things a bit happier for you. Yes, I think I'm given just to show our commitment to Wales, we are willing to announce on the television that we will launch a Welsh language television channel. It's been lovely doing business with you. Bore da.
This is good. If we so the schools and the doors now.
Yeah, that makes sense.
The government have got 310, and the opposition have got 312. But if we get our three Plaid people in, if they get on the telly and announce on national television that we're going to launch a Welsh language television channel, then that'll make 313, and we'll win the vote.
If there's anything you want said on the television, now's the time to tell them.
Welsh language television.
Let them know in the studio.
Welsh language television.
Voting has just finished in the House of Commons. The motion of no confidence was put forward by the Leader of the Opposition, Mrs. Thatcher, and the tellers have just informed the Speaker of the final result. In an unexpected move, former Labour MP Reg Prentice crossed the floor to vote with the government once again, and a large number of Conservative MPs were not present for the vote. There were 319 votes for the government and 306 votes for the opposition.
That was amazingly loud. So, Henry Zeffman, we saved the government.
We did. And proof that we absolutely are right to be as critical of politicians as we are in our day jobs, because we're so much better at it. If only Theresa May had appointed me chief whip.
And actually, my big takeaway from it, and particularly for the purposes, and speaking of Theresa May especially, given this is basically her experience for the entire government, is that at the end of the day, it all comes down to the politics. The only thing we really needed to focus on was the whipping.
Yeah, it was actually a genuinely interesting political lesson, which is, you know, somewhere in the other side of the theatre, there was this big conversation about civil unrest in Dagenham and something somewhere in Wales. And it did not matter at all. We won the day because we had a majority in the House of Commons. And actually, genuinely, that is what happened in those crazy years of Theresa May's government. What was going on in the country was pretty much irrelevant, except insofar as it made some Conservative MPs quite anxious. She had a parliamentary majority for a long time. That basically drained away, and that was the moment at which she was replaced as Prime Minister.
So that was how we actually got on. But it was an extraordinarily complex thing that they were doing. So that, just to explain, that when we were negotiating with the unions, if we gave the unions a very big pay rise, that pushed up inflation. If we managed to hold that down, then the stock market was going up and down. There's a treasury index. There was a sort of monster spreadsheet behind the scenes updating it all. And in a moment, we're going to hear from the play's director and the writer about how they made it work and why, what made them think, I'll tell you what will be really popular, an immersive theatrical experience about the Callaghan government in 1979. Turns out it's really good. We'll speak to Owen Smith and Tom Black next here on Times Radio. It's Matt Jolly in association with GoDaddy, providing the helping tools you need to grow your business online.
Matt Chorley on Times Radio with GoDaddy, providing all the help and tools you need to grow your business online.
Hey, good morning, it's Matt Chorley on Times Radio. So, this week, Henry Zeffman and I, with producer Chloe, went to play Crisis What Crisis in a brilliant immersive theatrical experience where you're sort of thrown into the Labour Party in 1979 trying to save the Callaghan government. Which we did quite comprehensively, Henry. We did very well. But let's speak to how on earth do you come up with that, and how do you make it all work with all the sort of various moving parts? It is a creation of the new Diorama Theatre, and we can now speak to the play's director, Owen Smith. Hi, Owen.
Hello there.
And the writer, Tom Black, and writer and star, I should say, Tom Black. Hi, Tom.
Hello there. Sorry to open with a correction, but actually, Owen's very polite. His name's Owen Kingston rather than Owen Smith.
Owen, well, that's
he's not the former Labour MP, Owen Smith. As excellent as that.
Yes, I think that's what it was. We've got obscure Labour MPs on the brain.
That's understandable.
I apologise, Owen. I apologise.
Not to worry.
So, first of all, whose idea was this? That's my sort of first question.
Well, originally it came from Tom, and we just got finished in another show about set during the Second World War, and Tom and I were talking about what we might want to do next. And Tom originally pitched this as a board game idea. The idea that we could create a board game set in the late 70s about that very specific period of history. And he was sort of explaining how he thought it might work. And I said, well, why don't we just make a show? And do
and I said,
this.
Well, because no one would buy any tickets, Owen. as you very kindly said, Matt, it turned out there was an audience for this kind of thing, and Owen, had the gumption to say, well, let's give this a damn good go, and we ended up throwing what you saw together, and it turns out that actually the show is, whenever we put it on, topical in its own way. You've talked in your feature there about the Theresa May government. Obviously, when we first put it on in 2019, that kind of Brexit deadlock in Parliament was all on people's minds, and now that it's back now, obviously that's somewhat in the past, but obviously with COVID and the government, you know, scrambling to respond to an unexpected emergency, there are sort of different themes that come to the fore with every audience.
And Owen, you're the spreadsheet mastermind, is that right?
Not quite. Tom's the one that actually wrote the spreadsheet. So when we first made the very, very first prototype of the show, I'd come up with a lot of mechanics, the things that you see in the economy, for example, about the treasury and inflation and so on. And we kind of worked out how to do all that on paper. But on the very first test, we very quickly realised we couldn't just hold all of that information in our heads. We needed a way of being able to bring it all together and see the state of the show at a glance, and also make sure that we were tracking things properly and that things didn't fall through the net. And so Tom went away with his visual basic head on and came up with this incredible spreadsheet full of macros, which has revolutionised how we do our work, really.
And then like Owen is behind the scenes operating it.
Yes.
Making it all happen live.
That's the thing. So how do you go about directing something, Owen, where there are so many moving parts and so many, I mean, how many different endings are there?
There's four broad endings to this, although a lot of variation. The honest answer is it's really hard. It's hard to try and track all that stuff and then make it have a meaningful impact on the show and get audiences to understand that the decisions they're making really are affecting what's going on. But we spent quite a long time developing how to do this sort of work. And the very first show that we did in this manner was set during an alternate history Second World War, where the audience get the chance to be the war cabinet and see off a German invasion. So we played around with the Operation Sea Lion idea of Britain being invaded during the war. And we did that immediately after the Brexit vote. So it was actually 2017. So it was about a year later that the show went on. But that was a kind of a response by us to how people were talking about Churchill and invoking the spirit of Churchill as a kind of a totem for Brexit. And so we just wanted to give British people that experience of being invaded, because that's the thing that separates us from the rest of the continent, you know, that memory of the war. And so then we developed this method of trying to track how audiences were making decisions and then giving them responses to those decisions dynamically, so that the show wasn't just on rails. And, you know, most theatre has to be on rails, but we wanted to use that live responsiveness that the actors could have in the moment to give things, to bend the show around the audience, really, and to make it unique every night.
What are the weirdest endings you've ended up with? Because ours was actually pretty mainstream. In fact, the crowd we were among basically seemed to decide that Jim Callaghan should behave like Margaret Thatcher did the next year and go full monetarist.
And without, I don't think it's giving too much away to say there were quite a few people who work for the current Labour Party who were there and came along with us
we
on the journey
of
pursuing pursuing a Thatcherite policy of standing up to the unions, keeping inflation low and watching the stock market boom.
Absolutely. Well, we do have, as Owen says, there's four broad endings, but lots of different variation. One example of that is, as you say, you had a fairly healthy win in the vote of no confidence, but you did it at perhaps the left's view would be at the cost of the Labour Party's soul, for example. We get some people along who are very sort of proudly, you know, moving forward, you know, creating new Labour early and so on. There are other people who see that in a very different light. There are other ways to maybe just hold the line and sort of maybe just eke out a very narrow win, but you do sort of keep the social contract going, try to maintain the post-war consensus. But that is a lot harder because, of course, it would have been a lot harder in 1979 to do that. Similarly, you can, as I'm sure you gathered, you can lose the vote. And if things go truly chaotic and you completely lose control, let's just say certain members of the business community and the armed forces decide that they might be able to do a better job than the government, if you take my meaning.
But you know what, actually, the thing is, because what we do sort of as political commentators and journalists a lot of the time is just sort of in the context of, well, that's not worked out how they wanted it to work. When you are suddenly faced with decision, well, what do you actually think, my own personal political view of what do you think should happen? I got the feeling that lots of people were a bit sort of conflicted. On the one hand, they thought that they were of the left or of the Labour Party, but suddenly they were like, well, we don't want to give... Actually, maybe we shouldn't give the unions everything they're demanding. And you do feel like you're having that sort of personal conflict live during the course of... Actually, I mean, it is also a lot of fun. We should also mention as well, Henry, your experience of discovering some old technology.
Well, I was very impressed, Matt, that it turned out that you had used one of those... I don't even know what they're called, the old style phones where you have to push around the dial. That took some getting used to. Also, one of our fellow sort of fairly young audience members broke the fax machine at one point, which was quite amusing. In fact, he kept saying, I need to send a fax to Joan Maynard and it won't work. Which was
that is the
surreal.
Authentic 1970s experience.
Yes, and the dial phones.
That's what it's called.
Rotary dial phones completely baffled Henry. And honestly, the set, it was incredible. The set, well, I suppose it is a set. You know, the all of the furniture, the phones, the fax machine, the posters on the wall. You really did feel like you were right in it. And then you know, my opportunity to go on LBC and speak to Bob Holness was just too much. It was just much too exciting. And then generally by the end, when we were watching the climax and the TV broadcast and then listening out for the vote, it was genuinely exciting. And in a way that I possibly didn't think I'd be quite so caught up in it when we set off on that journey. Do you find that a lot with your audiences? Is there a point at which you realise, oh, OK, they're in this now?
Yes.
Yeah. In the first half hour or so, people tend to be a little bit, understandably, maybe a bit reserved. Maybe they don't know the period very well. Maybe they think, oh, is this just a paperwork simulator? But as Owen said earlier, the company Parabolic Theatre has got a lot of experience of feeding back audiences' decisions to them later on to show them how they've impacted the show. And it sounds like you guys have had that experience. Once people realise, oh, what I did mattered, the second they do that, they're really interested in doing a lot more. And certainly by the end, we have people, as you've touched on, from all bits of the political spectrum, bought into, well, whatever we decided to do tonight, we're going to try and hold the line. Let's do it together. And yeah, but there's real tense moments at the end of the show from all comers.
Just finally then, what next? You've done the war, you've done the union crisis. What next?
We're actually probably going into the future next. Just before the lockdown, we did an extensive test of creating a show set on a starship, wanting to give people that sort of feeling of being in Star Trek or similar sorts of TV series. And so we have been developing all through the lockdown a very elaborate show, which would have a sort of movie quality starship set. And then letting our audiences loose in that into the world of intergalactic politics, making all that stuff up for what the future might look like. Amazing. In 100 years' time.
Amazing.
That's
what you're doing next. Well, best of luck with it. We have to say we loved it. And I think it's now been extended, isn't there? Some new tickets are going on sale. So go and see. If you can, go and have a go at Crisis What Crisis. Really love to speak to you. Owen Kingston there, the director, and Tom Black, one of the actors and writers of the show. It's on at the New Diorama Theatre in North London. It's the production by Parabolic Theatre. I should have got that right at the beginning. Genuinely, it's a lot of fun. If you like this, what we do on the show here, it's basically exactly that, but played out in real time, and you can have a beer in your hand. And you enjoyed it as well, Henry.
I loved it. Almost as great as it has been to be here in the studio with you, Matt. You look just like you look on Twitter.
This is the immersive theatrical experience that is appearing on Times Radio. That's all we've got time for on this episode of the Red Box Podcast. Don't forget you can listen to me live Monday to Friday, 10 till 1 on Times Radio. And we bring you the best bits here on the podcast. And if you're feeling particularly nice, why not wait and review us wherever you get your podcasts from?
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.